Known for its big budgets, big pages and even bigger egos, the world of fashion publishing perhaps isn't best known for self-reflection. This week on The Stack, we speak to the editor of a magazine aiming to be a platform for critical thinking in fashion. Plus a closer look at the weekend supplement looking to change the pace of the busy lives of Financial Times readers. All that to come here on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. During the working week, the Financial Times pink pages are all business. But the weekend edition of the newspaper is more than happy to follow its readers out of the boardroom and into the theatre, down to the beach, or off to the department store. Earlier this year, its weekend offering was revamped, including a redesign of the FT magazine. Joining me now in the studio is the editor of the FT weekend magazine, Alice Fishburne. Tell me a bit about the FT Weekend magazine, of course, redesigned relatively recently. How does this fit into the FT family? I mean, everyone's familiar with the FT, aren't they, wherever they are. Where does it fit in that, in the stable?
I think we like to think of ourselves as being, well, we are a core part of the FT Weekend offering. Obviously, the weekly FT and FT Weekend are slightly different to each other. They have slightly different audiences. FT Weekend is very much top of its game when it comes to arts coverage, but we also like to think it takes all of the best bits of the week, you know, the breadth of our international reporting, the really interesting business stories, and just offers them to readers in a slightly different way, the way you might want to read if you have an hour to spend on the sofa rather than rushing into your desk in the morning. And the magazine is a core part of all of that, and we have beautiful photography. Obviously, the format of our pages allows us to go to town with design and illustration, graphics. We have an amazing photo team. And we also just produce really great, I think, long-form features and interviews.
Well, yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because, and I mean this as an absolute compliment, I think there's something sort of reassuringly, I don't know what the word is, almost maybe traditional about some of the presentation. It's just the ideas of letting, you know, great large photos tell the tale, writing and lots of it from great writers. Do you think in some respects people overcomplicate the occasionally dark art of magazine making? Actually, this sort of winning formula is there for everyone if you have the confidence to stick with it.
It's funny you say that because as you said, we did a redesign back in March. And one of the things when we were doing that I and the art directors were very keen to bear in mind was simplifying things. Because I feel that in today's 24-hour news cycle, there's just stuff coming at you all the time, whether it's on Twitter or the TV or the radio or in print. And we just wanted people to just be able to relax and lose themselves in a story and to let, as you say, the photography shine. You know, we use big pull quotes. We're not afraid to experiment with typography, things like that. But we don't want the pages to look very, very cluttered. And the other thing to bear in mind is that this stuff is being read not only in print, but also in a digital format. And we had been in a stage where we were producing lots of stuff for print that wasn't being used digitally, that didn't make sense online. And I think more and more as we commission on a dual track, we have to bear in mind that everything that we commission for print needs to work in some way online. So that also meant that simplifying things sometimes was for the best.
And that strikes me as interesting. So is that then, it properly is in your head during the commissioning process when you're looking at sort of flat planning issues from week to week, you're thinking about it as a print offering and as a digital offering right from the outset?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there are some things we do that are digital only, and there are some things we do that maybe don't have such a big digital life, although everything now does appear on our website. But yeah, we completely bear that in mind from the beginning. We've adjusted our production schedules to take into account building the stuff for online. I mean, we very much, everything is commissioned on that. All of our writers work to that as well. And we work very, very closely with our colleagues who push what the FT is doing digitally to make sure that we're incorporating all of that into our thinking.
And do you think that, is it consumed then in the same way? Because I'm interested, you struck that image, and I think people who read the FT at the weekends will have this idea of, yeah, the weekend papers, it's gentle, there's, you know, you pour over the food pictures, which as ever always look good enough to almost eat off the page. But it's different though, isn't it, if you're looking on a tablet? Or does that not trouble you? If it is different, if the pace of consumption is different, that doesn't really enter your thinking.
I mean, the good news is that nowadays the analytics are so sophisticated that we're able to track quite a lot of our readers' behaviour. And I have to say, it's reassuring as someone who specialises in long form that those stats are have been very positive. People do really, really engage with this stuff online as well as in print. They might read it in a slightly different way, so they might look at it and think, oh gosh, that's a 4,000-word story. I'm just heading into my desk. I'll save that for later.
Come back to that one.
Yeah. But they do actually come back to it, and we can see, you know, we can track how far down the page they're getting. We can see how much their click-through rate is. So it's all been good news for us, and it could easily not have been. But I'm very pleased that our hunch that long form is just as successful online has been paying off in terms of the stats. I mean, we do think about people's journey through the site and if they're coming into something through social media, where they might go next. So yeah, it is very much a different part of our brain and one that we're trying to use all the time as well.
Now, I always try and ask editors about the sort of anatomy of stories and the pace of the week and how things shape up. Give us an example. If we're looking at, say, oil, which is, of course, the big piece here on the front of the latest edition, how does a story like that come together? Is it sort of weeks, months, years in the planning? Do you sort of have things that you come back to? Sometimes you're quite reactive. What's a typical front page story, for example?
Well, so for the oil story, that one has been a few months in the planning, not least because we had to get the writer into the Arctic Circle, which was harder than you
no
might think.
Feat.
I mean, it is a big
tourist.
I imagine
that's fairly complicated. Anyway.
It's a big tourist spot, but by the time you'd found flights, got the photographer, got them camping in a tent together on a hillside for a week. So something like that, it does take a certain amount of planning. And also, they're big stories to write. You know, for this one, he went, he did the camping, he talked to the locals, he went around the island, he went out with the fishermen, but then he also went to Oslo, talked to the Prime Minister. So, you know, those are two very important strands of what is now a huge story about oil and the Norway's battle for its soul, and are they an environmentalist? Are they the biggest petroleum producer? What happens if both of those things are true? I'd say for most of our stories, we've got some that are on the books for a long time, you know, complicated investigations, things like that. They can take up to a year to pull off. In other instances, we're lucky in that our deadlines allow us to be fairly nimble. So we have, it doesn't happen very often, but we have in the past been able to sort of rip up a magazine at a couple of days' notice before deadline and get in a new cover story. So, for example, when Fukushima happened, I mean, we the timings worked, so we were able to turn around a cover story the week that that happened. So we do that if we can. Again, when Thatcher died, we did it. But mostly it's, I'd say, 2 or 3 months on cover stories.
Long time planning. Tell me a little bit more then about, I don't know the comparison, if we jump, you've got a few recent editions spread on the table here in front of you. And this is interesting to me from a sort of an editorial viewpoint, but also from an art direction viewpoint. You mentioned earlier working with your art, colleagues in art direction. Is it very important to you that there's a, I don't know, a sort of strand that runs from week to week, and people say, ah, yes, you know, this is an FT Weekend magazine cover? Or are you looking at trying to surprise people, maybe have people almost do that sort of double take as they take it out of the rest of the weekend paper?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that we were committed to a particular template with our design. In fact, we're very much not. I'd say that we're very committed to running, you know, the best photographs. We have a particular style in terms of how we do quotes, things like that. But we do want to surprise people. We do want to go, I mean, if you look at the three magazines I brought in today, you know, you've got an up-close portrait of Gordon Ramsay. You've got an archive shot of the riots in Detroit. It's just been the 50th anniversary with a really big quote to go with it. And then you've got this mad Natural History Museum exclusive cover of a giraffe's leg. And inside with that, when our designer started looking at that, he said to me, don't look at it, because you're not going to like it. And I was like, oh, God, here we go.
They always
and
come then, out with things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly. You can't comment yet. And then not till I finished. And then when he did, he'd rotated the entire magazine. So everything, when you look at the photographs, it's sort of at a 90-degree angle. And it means that you get the whole breadth of the page for the photographs. And that was fantastic. And he's right. If I'd seen that at an early stage, I might have been like, ooh, a bit. Mm. But I trust him to experiment. And I'm really lucky to work with a great team who have lots of good ideas and who aren't afraid to kind of push the envelope when needed.
Absolutely. More power to them. And you definitely can't do that with digital, can you? Even on a tablet, it doesn't quite work.
No,
it doesn't quite work the same way.
The iPad does flick things around. But
a little bit. It's not as arresting. And tell me about another key cornerstone of all the weekend reading experience is columnists. People love to read great opinion. And obviously, there's a brilliant roster in the FT Weekend magazine. Tell me a little bit about that. Is that like herding cats, easy to manage? You don't have to name names, but do feel free. But you know, it must be privilege, responsibility to sort of work with some, you know, super well-regarded names.
No, it is a total privilege. You're right. I mean, we have some great columnists who've been with us for a long time. So Simon Cooper, Gillian Tett, Robert Shrimsley, and Tim Harford, who sadly has now moved to the main paper, which I'm still a bit sad about, even though we do lure him back for the odd cover story. And they are total pros, and they're great. And actually, I'm incredibly lucky. I've worked on comment desks in other institutions, and you know, the FT people are courteous and polite and get their stuff in on time, more or less, and, you know, are a pleasure
more
to
or less
with.
Note.
Yeah, you know, there's always the odd slippage, but no, they're very good. I mean, we've introduced new, I mean, one of the things that I think is key is to continue to introduce new voices. So we have changed, we have this new Tech World column, which is three, actually they're all young women who write for us on a rotating basis. And that's great, and we're kind of bedding that in at the moment, and it's been very successful, actually. And I also run this slot called Observations, where we don't have any regular, well, Doug Coupland does it once a month, but other than that, we just have new voices every week. And it gives us an opportunity to just get fresh blood in and see if people are good. And some of those people have been so good that they've been pinched by other bits of the paper, which I find both reassuring that our taste isn't
very
bad,
very proud,
but also
and
annoying
very irritated
because they're no longer available for me to commission.
Just on that point, I'm often asked editors that we talk to on this programme about whether they need to be part editor, part publisher, or whether they need to wear a sort of a commercial hat at the same time. Do you find that you, I mean, I'm sure you're obviously very commercially aware about what does well, what doesn't, this sort of thing, but could you just be an editor anymore that doesn't have an eye or an understanding of some of those underlying commercial imperatives and pressures, or do you think you need to be able to do that as well?
I think it would be hard to be an editor today who existed in a complete vacuum with a unlimited bank balance and, you know, able to pay people £5
There goes my long-term plans.
That would be a wonderful place to be. I mean, no, obviously we're aware of the situation of the industry as a whole, and, you know, we have a very good commercial team. There's a Chinese wall, as always, down the middle, but we do talk to them about, you know, things, and we know the lay of the land. And, you know, we also do things like publish the occasional supplement if there's an area that, you know, we have enough writers who are interested in doing something on a particular theme and it might have advertising potential, then those do go in. But no, I mean, I'd say that you have to be smart about that stuff and you have to bear it in mind, but it certainly doesn't dictate anything that we produce.
What about a quick eye to the future, Alice, before we wrap things up? Can we get any world exclusives? What have you got coming up? Whet our appetites a little? We always try and find things to mark our card for the weeks and months ahead.
We are heading into August, so you're catching me at the... Well, not the dog days of the summer, but we've got some great stuff coming up. We've got an amazing photography issue coming up in August, which is just beautiful pictures of water and the beach and leisure. And it's going to have some great essays by good writers going with it. So I'd say that's one to take in your beach bag. And then come September, we're back in the swing of it. And we've got the FT Weekend Festival at the beginning of September, September 2nd. And there'll be lots of special stuff timed for that. So
watch this space.
Yeah.
So you're timing. Wonderful stuff. Alice, thanks so much for coming to see us. That's Alice Fishburne from the FT Weekend magazine. Alice, thanks for joining us on The Stack.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24. Earlier this month, an interview with long-serving British Vogue fashion director Lucinda Chambers clocked up two rare achievements. First, it was an industry interview that broke out of its wheelhouse and caught the attention of even those with no pre-existing interest in fashion. Second, and perhaps even more impressively, it was an interview with a fashion insider that was reflective and critical of the industry. Both of these effects are calling cards of Vestoy, the niche fashion journal that published the interview. Its stated mission is to be the platform for critical thinking on fashion. Now, to find out more, I'm joined now, I'm delighted to say, here in the studio by Vestoy's editor, Anya Aronofsky-Kronberg. Anya, welcome to The Stack. Let's talk a bit about big picture fashion industry and the fashion magazine publishing. Sometimes we say, oh, you know, this is an industry that's not that self-reflective. It's not very good talking about itself. Do you think there's anything to that? And how do you see Vestoy and Vestoy's role in that sort of world?
Yeah, the whole point of starting Vestoy actually was to bring some of that self-reflection into fashion, because I think you're right in saying that the industry in general that's not our forte. Many reasons, I guess, why that might be the case, but I think perhaps things that attract people to fashion have more to do with representation of images, with maybe a more intuitive approach rather than this cerebral approach that I tend to prefer. And then, of course, in fashion, there's that very strong influence from the industry, which I think for, not just for fashion, but any industry, makes it quite hard to be critical, at least. And criticism often goes hand in hand with self-reflection, or at least you have to be open to that aspect, no? Otherwise, what's the point of questioning yourself if you're not willing to look at, more difficult aspects.
And that's interesting. I guess if we pick up on, say, the Lucinda Chambers interview, of course, with the story about Vogue and the succession there, and Vogue's one of the magazines we have here in front of us. Is that an example where there was this sort of blurring of the line between public and private, and it was affecting people? You know, people were moving on and there was jobs at stake. And is that why everyone got so exercised by that? Because it was a bit of new territory to a degree. People weren't quite sure what was on, what was off the record.
I know. I've been thinking a lot about that, of course, in the aftermath of all the kind of hullabaloo surrounding that story. What was it that made it... why did it strike a chord with people in that way? And, certainly I think you're right in that it's unusual to have someone kind of puncture the myth, I suppose, that we otherwise try quite hard to uphold in fashion. So it's curious, actually, because I think a lot of the things that Lucinda told me are things that people, not just in the industry, but also consumers of fashion, are quite aware of. You know, like, for instance, the influence of advertisers, the limitation of creative freedom, let's call it. Or, I mean, even the fact that you might not always like the things that you do in your job. I mean, it's something most of us encounter, no? You don't have
very
to be...
very occasionally, only.
On the one hand, we knew a lot of those things before, but we're not used to someone saying them out loud. So it's that... I was thinking a lot about partly when you break rank, I suppose, but also... rupturing this smoke and mirrors that we are so used to when it comes to fashion in particular. It's like there are all these things that we can acknowledge and know, but we know not to talk about them. Mm. When someone defies expectation in that way...
It certainly gets people talking, wherever they are. And just on Vogue, I mean, obviously this period of succession, if you like, which was announced and then it's kind of happening in seemingly slow motion and the succession will continue. Is that a perennial problem for certainly some of the kind of big marquee titles that, you know, it's very difficult when you have changes in senior personnel? And I guess at Condé Nast, it's not just Alexandra, you've got changes in the boardroom as well. And that's... contributes to this feeling of flux and change. And does it make a lot of people feel the ground is less steady beneath their feet, maybe?
But that's certainly been the case in the fashion industry in general, because there's been a lot of talk about the ground shifting in fashion design houses, right? Mm. So designers enter into a house, often don't stay very long, and there's been a lot of debate around that in the fashion press.
So do you think it might even come from the world of fashion proper and have filtered into magazines, the idea that actually you can have a new broom and maybe it's a good thing to shake things up and change things around?
Rewind a little bit. Like, what's the purpose of a magazine like Vogue today, right? Or any fashion glossy that, in fact, hasn't changed its format in probably, I don't know, 2 decades, maybe more, you know, the way... This I was thinking about when you asked me to reflect a bit on a few of the current fashion titles. All right, there's a big change at British Vogue at the moment in terms of the creative team or management or whatever. But is that really enough? I mean, to me, it seems like it's the format that's the problem. Maybe not the person who's the editor-in-chief, because the editor-in-chief... or the fashion director or whoever it is, you know, the upper echelons of a magazine, they can only do,
so
you know,
much.
They can only work within the framework that's already set. And at very well-established, time-honored type titles like Vogue, that framework is really tight. I've been now extra carefully looking through Vogue, partly because I was researching the topic for my interview and also afterwards before coming here. And I was thinking, for instance, all those pages that begin a magazine like Vogue with all these little tips about what to buy or who's the hottest or, you know, what's she wearing, those sort of things. You know, in Vogue, they're called Vogue Spy or In Vogue or whatever, things like that. They're pages that are really similar. That kind of information, do readers want that from a fashion magazine? I don't know. Isn't that that's what I hear the internet is all about? You know, looking at what people, quote unquote, in the street are wearing or getting news and tips very fast. To me, it seems like that a fashion magazine, you know, on paper serves or should serve another purpose. Maybe something that has more to do with reflection. maybe that self-reflection that we were talking about earlier, maybe that's something that you would take the time to go on that journey when you have a magazine in your hands, when you're before bedtime or when you're en route somewhere and you have a little bit of space, not to just get that very fast, light information that traditionally we did get from fashion magazines. But, I mean, all of press and media has changed. So why are fashion magazines so slow in picking up on that? I just
maybe
don't get it.
It's ironic, isn't it, perhaps, that they're maybe quite small-c conservative, given that so much of what they are discussing and writing about is often very avant-garde or very progressive. Often it's maybe mired in, as you say, some quite received behaviours. And I wanted to touch upon that lightly in terms of some of the other magazines. I have the always heavyweight Purple Fashion here as well. If you look across the fashion newsstand, I don't know, is it a source of frustration or curiosity for you when you see certain titles that maybe are fairly traditional with their approach? And that's, I'm being polite with traditional.
Well,
what do you make of that?
You know what? I'm the kind of person that gets a lot of energy out of being against things. So for me, it's like that frustration that I feel when I go into a magazine shop is, in fact, what made me start Restoy in the first place. It's what makes
it.
Me.
It's a good thing then. We got
for me,
good out of it.
Certainly. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, really, I never failed to be amazed at the amount of titles on the shelves of magazine stores that are so similar. I mean, maybe they are aesthetically, they differ a bit from one another. You know, you have some that are more celebrity driven, or it's the kind of Hollywood type celebrity driven, let's say, or glossy or whatever, and then you have others that fall under this banner of independent but the difference is just, it's marginal. It's just different languages to talk about clothes, or different dialects, let's say, to talk about clothes in the same language. I don't understand, when producing a magazine, you can be very nimble in doing that. You don't need a lot of people. You don't need an office necessarily, because the advertising sector of magazines is shrinking. It's not really something you can rely on. You have to think of other ways of funding, or you don't even have to follow the seasons. I mean, there are so many ways of approaching it. Why is it that we are, it seemed to have some kind of limitation of imagination when it comes to approaching fashion?
Well, that strikes me as interesting then. So without the pages of Vestoy, which is this progressive beacon in this space, where else do you look then to find that voice that is critical, that is more reflective? Is it a question of going, is it about online? Are there these digital voices that you follow? Is it conversations you have quite literally face to face with people instead? Or are there little pockets or corners, even in print, where you can find fresh writing and clear ideas and maybe even a bit of progressive thinking?
Well, for me, conversations are always the most inspiring. Conversations and observation, I think. For me, just being, having one foot at least in the, steadily in the industry, or, trying to hang on in there at least, being able to go to shows, being able to partake in industry events, that's where I get all my ideas, just looking at how we behave, like trying to notice my own behavior, trying to figure out why am I feeling anxious in this environment, or what is it that makes me feel excited about this new thing that I'm seeing, or whatever it is. When it comes to reading, I'm a sort of omnivore, I guess. I mean, I read a little everywhere, like most people, I like long form writing a lot. So I go on that website called longform.org and go through whatever they might have. Or I had a period where I read Cabinet, which I quite liked. Their unusual takes on topics, which I find inspiring. But there's no one magazine, actually. It's funny, thinking about it, considering that I make a magazine. I've never been such a voracious magazine reader. I like oral history very much. So lately I've been reading a lot of oral history and trying to think, how can I bring that approach into fashion? It's something that I find inspiring when I do interviews. How can I tell a story that has to do with, I don't know, where you feel you get to know the human being? That's something I lack often when I read profiles of people in fashion, when I read fashion magazines. I read all these pages about some new designer or some person that seems very interesting, but I read like six pages and I feel I didn't get to know this person at all. It's just frustrating because why would... I mean, ultimately, as a human being, surely you want to feel like you have some kind of connection with another human being. Otherwise, it ends up being very alienating. That's the thing.
And is that because you think people are so concerned about, you know, images, everything, and the presentation of the aesthetic is viewed as being the fundamental thing? Does that mean that people shy away from revealing the layers, revealing the depth, whether it's of their personality or their inspirations? Or is it, again, this problem that people are a bit too conservative? They're too worried about showing
how we appear,
and showing a bit of the substance behind. There's a lot of veneer on everything. Mm,
well, it's certainly partly that. And then there's the, you know, what we talked earlier about the influence of corporations and brands on the fashion press, which is huge, particularly now when fashion press, I mean, press in general, but we're talking fashion here. So fashion press is being squeezed. Funding isn't what it used to be. Advertising isn't what it used to be. Things like that.
Then it's fairly transparent, though, isn't it? I mean, do you think readers understand that there's a relationship between publishers and advertisers and therefore potentially between editorial and publishers and advertisers? I mean, it's not like this is concealed from people, is it? I mean, you mentioned smoke and mirrors. It's fairly transparent,
look,
isn't it?
It's transparent because we know, but we're more sophisticated readers, but I don't think it's transparent because there's an aim to be transparent. I mean, those are different things. I think in a fashion magazine, typically, you on the one hand have your traditional ads, right, that we often as readers just don't even, you know, it's like 93 pages I counted in The Gentlewoman, I think, the most recent issue. Like, you can just flip those and then start reading what you think is like the quote-unquote real content. But then, of course, there's that relationship between the advertisers that put money into a publication that then expects some editorial type content in return. And that's where it gets more blurry, because that is not signposted, you know.
Yeah.
In the interview I did with Lucinda Chambers, she talked about a T-shirt she put on a front cover of Vogue, which came from a big advertiser of the magazine. Those sort of things are not fronted with. And even if the reader, the sophisticated reader, they might still be able to make that connection just out of their own wits. Still, the effectiveness of that T-shirt on that cover of Vogue, let's say, it's effective because you don't know it. Or if you know it, you can suspect it, but you shouldn't really know it. And also, I think there's a lot of suspension of disbelief. I wonder if that's right. Like, think of advertising, for instance. You look at an ad, at a perfume ad, you know it's been, the woman in that ad has been airbrushed. You know the importance of lighting, or you know that she's had professional makeup and hair and blah, 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 all those things that everybody knows now. So you know that image is not real. You know that if you buy that perfume, you're not going to get any closer to her lifestyle, you know. But we still fall for it, don't we? We still want the perfume. That's the funny thing. It's like we can intellectually know, but emotionally we're still affected.
Mm. It's the willing suspension of disbelief that you mentioned.
That's it.
You mentioned just before, exactly.
Thanks, Englishman.
okay, let's look to the future then. So how does Vestoy continue to navigate a path through, whether it's choppy current waters about a succession at Vogue or some of these problems that the industry faces, which, I mean, one might say, especially from the way you describe them, that they're quite profound challenges, whether that's contracting advertiser revenue or maybe some cynicism from the public about aspects that you've reflected on. How are you choosing to strike your path? What are the key markers that are going to inform the decisions that you continue to make?
I very much want Vestoy to be an alternative.
There you go. A call for action and a good note, perhaps, on which to end. And I know we kept talking about reflection, but to sit here and reflect with you on different magazines and on Vestoy and on all these big questions has been a pleasure. Thanks very much for coming to see us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And you can read the new issue of Vestoy in December. And the topic of that, appropriate enough, we might say, after what we've been talking about, is on authenticity. You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24. And that is all we have time for on this week's programme. Thanks to our production team, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Rhys Sheridan, and to our editor, Cassie Galpin. Get in touch with Fernando. He's on fp@monocle.com. And you can join us on The Stack at the same time next week. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you for listening.